Hi, I'm Anna Harris, and this is the Defined by God podcast, a support resource for Christians looking for hope and healing from trauma and adversity. Join us as we interview experts, hear stories of healing from real people, and discuss and define common types of trauma, how it impacts us, and the latest and best strategies for healing and thriving. Hi, everyone. Thank you so much for joining us today. I'm very excited to introduce my guest today. Her name is Dr. Deborah Wingfield. And Dr. Deborah has more than 46 years of experience in working with abuse and abuse survivors across the lifespan. She has counseled children and adults who have experienced abuse, and she's been on staff of a couple of different universities teaching about this very thing. And so I'm really excited for her to join us. October is Domestic Abuse Awareness Month. And so that's why we're releasing this in October. I think it's so important for people to understand what domestic abuse is and what it looks like, because a lot of times we do not recognize it when we maybe should. So let me bring on Dr. Deborah and we can talk more about this. Hi, Dr. Deborah. How are you doing?
Good. How are you, Anna?
I'm doing well. Thank you so much for coming on today.
Thank you for inviting me.
Yeah. Would you like to, I gave a little introduction. Would you like to tell us a little bit more about who you are and what you're doing with educating people about domestic abuse?
Well, I've been working, as you said, with abuse survivors and also with perpetrators for well over 40 years. I think it might be closer to 50 years at this point. And now what I'm doing is I'm passing on the wisdom that I have learned over that period of time to advocates who want to be supportive of survivors. And I work in conjunction with Call to Peace Ministries, mm-hmm. training individuals who want to be advocates, working with their program, and also just being a resource and educator for all kinds of things that come up around advocacy, including the family court issues. And family court is a big issue with domestic violence survivors. And we're going to talk about a little bit more about coercive control and how coercive control is a big part of that.
Yes. And I met you through Call to Peace Ministries. That's the first time that I had heard of you and what you do, because I've been doing the training, with advocacy there as well. And I just think your training is so thorough, and also you're just a good teacher. And so, you know, people understand what you're teaching. So, but yes, so we're going to talk more about coercive control and what it is. But first, tell us, how did you get started with in this field? What made you interested in it?
I had been working with abuse survivors from the very beginning of my career. And then I was starting my doctoral internship, and I didn't have any clients in my soon-to-be husband, he wasn't my husband at that time, was doing a group with perpetrators, and his co-facilitator wasn't available. So he asked me if I would sit in the group with him. And it was eye-opening. Mm-hmm. And I walked out of that group, and I said to Chuck, I said, before I ever walk into another one of these groups, I need to know what makes these guys tick, because there's something different about how they behave, how they think, what they choose to do. So I went on a journey to learn from experts about perpetrators. And mm-hmm. as I was doing that, I then started drawing into my private practice survivors and victims of domestic abuse and coercive control. So I just broadened the gamut there from just perpetrators all the way to survivors. And now my focus in my quote retirement years, we kind of all laugh about that. But yeah. I work mainly with survivors and help mm-hmm. them with their family court cases.
Right. That's wonderful. So we have some slides. I'm going to go ahead and pull those up. And let me see over here. There we go. So the first one said, is it domestic violence or coercive control? And it's really good for us to understand the difference, because I think a lot of people still think in terms of a domestic violent incident, like it's a one-time thing. But really, it's much more complicated and layered than that. So can you just go ahead and explain that to us, the difference between coercive control as we understand it and domestic violence?
Okay, so before we go further into this slide, let me define what the legal definition in most states is for domestic violence. And it usually involves some type of physical violence. In other words, there has to be an injury, there has to be property damage, something that physically shows this person was violent. Mm-hmm. And as lay people, we tend to think that the only kind of domestic violence is physical violence. What we right. know from the researchers, and I do want to mention Evan Stark, because he's the one that really brought all this together in his book, Coercive Control, How Men Entrap Women in Personal Life. And what he discovered was there was many, many more layers than just that physical violence. Mm-hmm. And although mm-hmm. that is something that the Duluth Project had identified, and we'll be looking at their power and control wheel in a few minutes, what most people were not identifying was the coercive control, especially without physical violence. Mm-hmm. So now we know that the landscape is changing. We know, and you can go ahead, and it's moving from domestic violence to coercive control. So if you look at the picture behind the words domestic violence, you can see it's kind of barren. And what we have there is a polarization. You know, you either have physical violence or you don't. And we only care about physical violence. Now what we understand is it's much broader than that. And mm-hmm. so with coercive control, we have many, many more layers. So you can see the trees in the background actually represent those multiple layers, and how, you know, if you just even think about a forest, how they grow at different levels and different things are going on underneath the forest. And so what we want to do is we want to really look at more depth of what is coercive control. And how is that a different way of looking at domestic violence, rather than just keeping it in that narrow lens of it's got to be physical?
Yes, that's really good. Let me just say, for the people that are listening on the podcast, the audio version, we are showing some slides. We're going to describe them, but you can also go to the website definedbygod.com/episode32. And we're going to have those slides. We'll have the PDF version of the slides that you can look at, you can download. So definedbygod.com/episode32. And you can find the slides there. Okay, go ahead, Dr. Deborah.
All right. Thanks, Anna. So the first thing that we want to look at is, how do we define coercive control? So coercive control is a pattern of oppression. It's an offense to liberty that prevents women from freely developing their personhood, utilizing their capacities, or practicing citizenship with consequences they experience as entrapment. Now, that comes from Evan Stark's book that was published in 2007, and that was his definition. If we break that down just a little bit, first of all, we're looking at oppression and a pattern of oppression. And many of our students who are going through our advocacy course are looking at that from a biblical standpoint as well, because mm-hmm. biblically, oppression is definitely a problem. And remember, I'm a secular scholar, so I'm not going to get into biblical pieces. But an offense to liberty, that means they're taking away a person's agency, taking away their ability to move freely, to think freely, to be involved in their community freely. So taking that away and isolating them and keeping them from developing who they are as a person. So we see as survivors, many, many women who have been either refused education past high school or have been demeaned for the jobs that they have or even discounted the need for them to have jobs. So it keeps them from utilizing their capacities. So as a woman who was in that situation, I was put down by my ex-husband and by his parents for even wanting to finish up my bachelor's degree. Mm. And so I had the mental capacity. It's pretty obvious. I now have mm-hmm. a doctorate. But just being put down for even wanting a bachelor's degree because it wasn't needed.
Right.
The attitude was I was there to make babies so that he could carry on the family legacy. And then practicing citizenship, being able to decide what do I want to do from day to day, being able to decide how I think about any area that's going on in life. So maybe it's politics, maybe it's my religious beliefs, maybe it's how I believe children should be raised. All of those things were being denied. And that consequence is to experience that as entrapment. Mm-hmm. And we're going to talk more about entrapment as we go further. And then we have a different definition from Robert Johnson in his book. Coercive controlling violence or intimate terrorism is violence that occurs in the context of coercive control. So he's separating the two out a little bit. Mm-hmm. I bring them all together because for me, it's all part of the same package with the use of both violent and nonviolent tactics. So we see a lot of women who experience nonviolent tactics that are basically attacking their souls. Mm. And we have to really understand how that emotional abuse, that, again, discounting, demeaning of her, actually takes away from who she feels she has the ability to be.
Yes. And it, especially over years and years, it can so just limit someone in their personal growth and ability to develop.
Oh. Right. So what it comes down to is then it's aimed at maintaining dominance over one's partner. Mm-hmm. And that's where we come into power and control. So when we're exerting power, when the abuser is exerting power and control, one of the things that we find is they have many, many tactics that they use mm-hmm. in many areas of life. So if you'll go to the next slide, this is the power and control wheel that was originally developed through the Duluth Project in Minnesota. And what they found in their interviews with women who were actually in shelters, and they interviewed these women, and what they they found was these women actually were able to identify 8 different areas where they experienced different types of non-physical. So we're going to emphasize the non-physical, the non-physical tactics to keep them controlled. We're not going to go deep into these 8 areas. We're just going to briefly talk about them. So using intimidation, keeping her under his thumb, even in public where a certain gesture might signal to her to be quiet or to sit down or to just fade into the background. Using emotional abuse, again, putting her down, calling her names, even to the point of we hear all the time about men who do the silent treatment. They may not speak to her for days, weeks, months, and she has no idea what she can do to address that. Then using isolation, isolating her. So a lot of times we see that survivors have come out of a situation where he's agreed to homeschooling because then it keeps her at home. It keeps her isolated from having contact with other women. He may isolate the children and say the children can go to school, but they have to come directly home from school. They can't be in after-school clubs, no after-school activities. It's just home, school, home, and school. So we see that isolation. And then minimizing, denying, and blaming. So this area is very insidious because it's real hard to tell what he's doing, but he's doing it. So a lot of people say, what is gaslighting? Gaslighting is using tactics of minimizing, denying, and blaming. So he'll say, oh, I didn't say that. You didn't hear me right. Let me say that to you again. And he twists his own words so that she's confused about, you know, what is he really trying to say here? And he keeps her walking on eggshells and off balance. And then he turns around and blames her for the problems. So I had a great example from a woman that I am still working with where he's denying something that she has asked for the children. The children are asking for, but he's saying it's all her fault that it hasn't happened yet. And I'm just going like, I know her head is spinning because we've had enough conversations to know that, oh my goodness, you know, she has been doing something for several years trying to get this done for these children, and he's denying it and then shifts the blame for it not happening on her. And then again, using the children, making her feel guilty about the children, making her say, making her the one that is responsible if a child acts out, if a child gets in trouble in the community or in trouble in school. You know, it's all her fault because she didn't do a good job of disciplining them. She didn't parent them right. So again, we see a lot of use of children, and post-separation, we see that escalate to where, you know, he will send child support payments through a child to give to mom after an exchange when a court order says specifically he can't do that. But he'll say, oh, well, I forgot and I needed to get it to you on time. And so I just gave it to our child to give it to you. And you see there, he's mixing, minimizing, denying, and then using the children with that. And using male privilege, we see a lot of men who believe that they are entitled to certain rights within the marriage and that they can do whatever they want to. And some of these men will say, I want sex 3 times a day, and you have to be ready for that. I want the children to be having these kind of haircuts. I want the children to be learning these kinds of things and out of these books. So they're constantly using their role as a male to dictate and take away her say. So again, taking away her agency. And using economic abuse. I cannot tell you how many women who will tell me, he just managed all the finances. He never told me what we had. He gave me an allowance. And sometimes he'll give her an allowance and then he runs out of money before the end of the week. And he'll demand that she give him some of that money back, even though she's getting a minuscule amount to possibly pay for a rent, pay for groceries, pay for clothing for the children, all of those kinds of things. And we have the other end of the spectrum where they use economic abuse to hide money, to defraud her of money, and then set it up like she was the one that was responsible for that. And we're having more and more of those kinds of situations come to light where he's actually committed identity theft by using her identity and then moving money away from her, and she doesn't even know about it.
Well,
and then using coercion and threats, pushing her to do things the way he wants to do it. I'm reading a book right now about the H stage progression to homicide in these cases. And this individual demanded that this one TV program, everyone in the family had to watch every single night. And if they didn't watch that program with him, it was tantamount to completely pushing against him. And just because I read this passage this morning, the children told her the night before he killed her that he did not demand that they watch that program that night, which was so out of character. And it was because he had already decided that he was going to kill her the next day.
Wow.
So again, we have to be so cautious and so aware of the safety as we're working with women, because they know what's going on and they know his patterns, and they know if he breaks a pattern, what that could mean for her. So knowing the different types of non-physical coercive control tactics is very important.
Yes. And that progression, I think that's important to understand. Because like I said at the beginning, when people will see there's been a, you know, a homicide in a family, or there's been domestic violence in a family, the old mindset and thinking, and a lot of people still have this understanding, is that it was a one-time thing. You know, things got out of hand and someone snapped, but that's actually not usually the case at all. It's usually found within a lot of this coercive control that you're talking about. So that's why it's important to recognize these things, because they can be leading to much even more serious things. Right. Not more serious, but more deadly and violent things.
Yeah, lethal. And actually, the author of this book is also destroying the myth that this is a crime of passion. It's he snapped. It's a one-time thing. None of those things are true. He's been thinking about this. He's very intentional in his control of her. And when he feels that he's losing control of her, that's when we start to see the escalation all the way to that lethal end.
Yes.
So, and many of those cases, there's never been any physical violence. It's all been non-physical coercive control.
Wow.
So let's talk about spiritual and religious abuse, because it's not on the original Duluth wheel, but we now have identified that. And this diagram actually just shows all those spokes again, but again, how this is done in a spiritual or religious setting. Mm-hmm. So this doesn't necessarily have to be a specific denomination. It can happen across all denominations. So if we start with that right-hand side and prolonging abusive relationships, many times we see women stay in these relationships 3 years longer because of their religious beliefs, because mm-hmm. of what they're hearing from their religious leaders or their elders. And what we want to do is we want to help them understand that, again, oppression is what's going on. It's not pursuing a divorce. Maybe it's pursuing a separation to see if he's even willing to look at himself. Mm-hmm. And I also want to say right here for your listeners that the majority of time, even if these men, quote, go into a program, they won't really make changes unless they have a real strong desire to do that. So we see a very small number of men who actually change. And we know from, again, the research that it can take 5 to 7 years for them to actually change those behaviors. Wow. So doing a 90-day or a 6-month program just doesn't cut it.
And I think that is one of the sad things about in Christian community is there is the idea that, you know, marriage is forever, and that a wife, especially a wife's role, is to stay and pray. And, you know, because you stay and you pray, be an example, and your spouse will change. When, you know, we know statistically that actually doesn't really happen. And so I agree with you that that is a reason that perhaps a Christian woman might stay even longer in an abusive relationship because of some of that teaching and belief system.
Yeah. And that holds across other religious groups as well that yes. hold marriage to a higher standard than the individual.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So with isolation, again, the abuser can either isolate her from a faith community or move her to a different faith community that he wants her to go to because he has control there. He has status there. And again, she is put in a less than role, and she's diminished as a result of that. They'll also use that community to coerce her into behaving. So what you said before about having her pray for him, having her, I can't tell you how many times I've heard women say, well, the pastor just told me I just needed to have more sex with him and everything would be okay.
Right.
And we know that's not true.
Right.
And then blaming her for the problems in the marriage versus holding him accountable for his behaviors. And I really want to emphasize that he is intentionally controlling. It's a choice that he makes, has nothing to do with any kind of mental health or personality disorders. It's strictly a choice that he's making. And the more I learn, and I'm learning still from others who've worked with perpetrators, the more I understand that it is a choice, has mm-hmm. nothing to do with any kind of diagnosis, has nothing to do with substance abuse, has nothing to do with porn use. So I just want to put that out there for your audience to understand. Yep. He may restrict her access or use of healthcare or control her access. Mm-hmm. And we're doing a current course on intimate partner sexual violence, where we're talking about how he can actually control her reproduction, determine when she's going to have children, when she's not going to have children. Wow. So that we have a lot of information that we can't pack quite into the 12-month advocacy training. So we add extra courses to answer questions like that.
Yes. And we'll tell at the end, we will tell people where to find the advocacy course that you're talking about.
Okay. So in using children, again, teaching children a very legalistic way of looking at the Bible so that it's either black or white and there's no gray areas. There's no areas for thinking your own thoughts, developing your own beliefs. And again, we see that controlling sexuality and reproduction. We just talked about that. And even to forced marriage, and then asserting authority, misusing scripture. And I can't tell you how many people we've heard have had their scripture twisted. And there's a great author who writes about that, Rebecca Davis. She's got several books on untwisting scriptures.
Yes.
So if you feel like you need some more help with that, I would definitely look at her books.
Yes, I highly recommend them. She's been on our podcast as well, and she's scheduled to come on again. So yes, totally agree with you there. Okay. So it's interesting. I've heard some people say, because the patterns are so similar in different people. And so some people will kind of jokingly say, what, did they all read the same book or something? But can you talk about, I think that might be our next slide, some of the tactics that coercive controllers use? What does that look like?
Okay. So in my book, Eyes Wide Open, Help with Control Freak Co-Parents, and I know you're going to put a link to that in here. Mm-hmm. What I looked at was the four C's: cunning, conning, convincing, and charming. And what we see is these men start out life being socialized to actually use these four C's to entrap a woman. And occasionally we see a woman who will entrap a man, but primarily we see men entrapping women. And if we go back to the 8-stage progression, even before they meet a woman, they are already trying to figure out, how are they going to find the right woman to control? How are they going to connect with her? And so when they meet a woman, they are looking for, is she controllable? And how does he need to get to her? Does he need to be very cunning and say the right things and give the right gifts? Does he need to con her into, poor me, I've had this terrible life, and I just need to be saved. I need somebody to rescue me and to make my life better. And appealing to her that way. Maybe they're very convincing. They're saying, I can take care of you. I can make your life better. I can rescue you from the awful childhood that you had. So come into my sphere and I'll protect you. And then they can be very charming, the hearts and flowers, the gifts, way too early in a relationship. And generally what we see with men in these relationships, we have a lot of red flags, which we can't go into today. But one of those big red flags is if they're moving into a relationship real quickly. So if they go, I'm meeting you in a bar and that's on Saturday, and by the following Saturday, they've already moved in with you. That's way too fast.
Yes. Or proposed, or yes, making long-term plans.
So the definitions for all of these are, of course, in my book, and it is available as a Kindle book. So if people are interested in that, as well as print.
I think it's so interesting too, like females typically, and can be, you know, males as well, but females typically, they want to help people, that nurturing, you know, side. And so sometimes you get trapped in that this person needs help. They were abused. They were whatever. And you want to help them. And so that can be part of, you know, why someone would stay in that relationship. You know?
Mm-hmm. Well, there's that part. And then women are socialized, not only in our society, but in societies around the world, that their role is to take care of people. Their role is to nurture. And their role is to be responsible for the relationship. And when we socialize women that way, and then we socialize men that they're entitled to all these privileges with women, what we have is the smoking gun that can go to an abusive relationship. So being coercively controlled doesn't mean that she asked for this. She was set up for it through socialization.
Yes. Even if you think of fairy tales and romantic movies, you know, it is totally setting people up.
Right. Yes. So if we'll go to the next slide, what I did is I started looking at the cycle of violence and realizing that the cycle of violence really didn't tell the true story of what was going on. And so I developed this diagram to show how coercive control entraps women into being brainwashed, gaslit, and being emotionally kidnapped. So I have seen women who are so coercively controlled that they go out to work every day. They come back home at the time that the abuser has designated they must be home. And they seem to move freely in society when actually they're not. They're being controlled emotionally. And so the way that that happens is it starts out with that grooming. So think of those four C's. Those four C's are part of that grooming process. How do I bring her into my web? And I specifically chose this design because it's like bringing her into a spider's web and bringing her deeper and deeper into it. So he takes her hostage right up front. And the way he takes her hostage is he convinces her that he's the best thing that could have ever happened to her. And then he uses coercive control tactics to see what will get her to agree to his control. So he tries different things out of those eight sections of that pie on the coercive, the power and control wheel. And then what he does is she says, this doesn't feel right. I need to get out of here. And she tries to escape. So what he does is he says, wait a minute, I've got to figure out how to pull her back in. Mm-hmm. And so he gauges her response to his tactics. And then he pulls her back in. So if she says she's leaving, then he's calling her, he's texting her, he's showing up at her door, he's outside her work, and, oh, you can't leave me, you're the love of my life, and he puts on that charm again and pulls her back in. And then she says, I'm not sure, I'm getting out of here. So then he tries alternative tactics, and this becomes a second stage of the grooming process where he grooms her to know that she can't get away from him, that he is going to control her life. And again, her response is trying to escape. And when she tries to escape, then he uses different tactics until he finds out what will bring her to a point of being submissive, and she fears fighting back. So when we think about women who leave and go back and women who leave and go back, and we know that the average number of times that a woman leaves is 7, what we're seeing is this captivity crime. And the reason that I talk about it as a crime in the United States, we're just beginning to make coercive control laws as part of our legal statutes. Some of those are in civil statutes, and very few of them are in criminal statutes. In the United Kingdom, they started making coercive control an actual criminal offense. That's a felony with up to 5 years in prison. And now today, we were just presented with some information that they have started checking on prisoners who were released from prison in the UK, and specifically a specific part of the UK. And those individuals were released with trackers on them, so that if they got within a certain distance of that victim, that law enforcement would rearrest them and they would go right back to prison. So we're getting some real help from individuals in the United Kingdom, in Scotland, in Ireland, in New Zealand, in Australia, that they're really criminalizing coercive control because it is the same and has even greater impact than physical violence. So yes, we really want to look at that. And I know this has just been a real quick overview of what we look at. But when you have someone that you might be friends with and you see them go back over and over, it's because he is brainwashing her. He's gaslighting her, and he's emotionally kidnapping her so that he can engage in entrapment. And that's what Evan Stark talks about in his book, Coercive Control.
And it's really, you know, even though it's emotional kidnapping, the person is just as captive as if it was a physical kidnapping. And so that is why we do need to look at it as a crime. And I hope that in the United States, people start to see it that way, and that we can get some laws, on the books for that.
Well, I do hope so. And I know if you look at the definitions of emotional kidnapping from the American Psychological Association, they are describing exactly what this diagram shows.
Well, so I think we can could give a little bit of a warning for people about, you know, we never, and you can, you know, add to this, but we never tell a woman you need to just leave, because there needs to be planning and all of that kind of stuff to make sure that it's, that she's leaving as safely as possible.
Yes. And only she knows when it's safe. Right. So one of the things that we teach in the advocacy course is we never give advice. We always provide options. We provide resources and solutions for her. It's her choice. And it may be the first time in her adult life that she's actually had choice. Because with coercive control, that choice has been taken away from her.
Yeah. So I think it's so important for the community at large to be aware of these types of things as well, so that when you're seeing that, you know, like you said, someone leaving, going back, or leaving, going back, you can kind of be aware of, you know, what the dynamics are with that.
So. Yeah. So one of the things to know and to consider doing is, if you have someone who you're friends with and you see that they leave and then go back, instead of walking away from that friendship, walk toward that friendship and say, I'm here for you whenever you're ready. Here are some local resources, and there are a lot of good local resources that we can provide. And that's part of our training, is talking about multiple resources, not only nationally, but locally, that women can access. And there are ways to do that. We're not going to get into any of that today.
Okay, so where can people get more information? I know your website is houseofpeacepubs.com, and your book is there. And then, like you mentioned before, you're teaching and training through the Called to Peace Advocacy Training Program, which is what I've been part of. And it is amazing training. I highly recommend it for anybody that is interested in knowing more. So the website, houseofpeacepubs.com, and your email and phone number is there.
And then for Call to Peace, it's calledtopeace.org, all one word.
Okay.
And there's information there. If people are needing advocates, they can request advocacy services there. If they need someone to speak to their pastors or someone in their churches, there's a church partners program that's a part of that as well. So we're trying to really bring education and awareness as well as support and help.
Yes, there's one of the programs is called Protect the Flock, which I think is so important, especially in the Christian community, so that pastors can be educated in this, because a lot of times a Christian woman will, if she's having trouble in her marriage, she'll go to a pastor for advice, which is why pastors need to really be informed, so that they can give good advice and not send someone back into a bad situation.
Mm-hmm. That's so true. And we've had many women who've been hurt by the churches because they don't understand the dynamics. And abusers come across very believable. Victims actually come across sometimes very dramatic and hysterical at the time, but that's because no one has paid attention. No one's listening. Mm-hmm. And that's what our advocates do. Our advocates are there to listen and to validate her experience.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yes. It's so good for people to be heard when they're trying to tell somebody, heard and believed.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, thank you so much for coming on today. I really, really appreciate it. I think it's very valuable information that you shared. What else would you like to say to people listening or watching the video?
So I would just like to say, if you're interested in either walking alongside survivors and helping them through their healing process as an advocate, you can do that. If you're a survivor and you want to know more and want to learn more, we have many survivors who go through our classes the first time around, and they're doing their own healing work. And then they'll come back and go through again. And we do let you come back for free as many times as you want after your first time through, and build up your skills, build up your knowledge. And we're constantly updating what the information is in those courses as well.
Yeah. Okay. Very good. Thank you. And thank you for everybody watching and listening. And feel free to go to definedbygod.com/episode32, the show notes, because we'll have all of the links and the slides that we shared. So thank you. Thank you, Dr. Deborah. And thank you, everybody that was watching.
Thanks, Anna.
Thank you so much for joining us for the Defined by God podcast. If you'd like more information, please visit our website at definedbygod.com and be sure to subscribe to our YouTube channel and email list.